Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, the first of 2019, kicking off season number four of the Retail Focus. We're brought to you this week by Blinkist, an app that distills the key insights of 2,500-plus best-selling nonfiction books into powerful 15-minute reads. We want to kick off 2019 with a big thank you to our listeners, whoever you might be, for the continued support. It's without you that the Retail Focus Podcast wouldn't have been possible all this time. A big thanks to everyone that we've interviewed over the years as well. This podcast has been probably more successful than even Leighton and I have imagined, and we want you to keep reviewing and liking us wherever you do subscribe to us. Also, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Leighton posting some videos at Retail Podcast on Instagram of his retail travels. I'll be doing the same thing as the year goes along. Well, for the first show of the new year, news is relatively light. Just to give you a little bit of an idea, as far as the retail news cycle at the beginning of the year, your stores and retailers are still chewing over their holiday shopping numbers. We should get holiday shopping updates this next week in terms of some of those numbers and potential same-store sales increases or decreases for retailers. So because of that, we're digging into a few macro trends and then kind of a hyper-local story that may be more regional than people think later on in the podcast. So we begin this week's episode with Reese. The research firm came out with their quarterly retail real estate report, reveals that vacancies mostly flat year over year in the U.S. This is for the fourth quarter 2018, with mall vacancies actually declining, something even we didn't expect to see. Across the board, we knew mall vacancies were slim in A and B class malls, but mall vacancies across the board declining. This comes from a story that we retweeted on Thursday of this week by CNBC retail reporter Lauren Thomas. And we see that retail real estate, as we've been talking about, still very healthy in the U.S. And Leighton, one of the things that we've discussed is certain markets, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Austin in Texas, Los Angeles, of course, their retail real estate vacancies are fairly low, but we're seeing this being the case mostly across the board, particularly for mall vacancies, which are actually sitting right now about 9%.
I recently visited a mall, and I'll talk about that a little later in the story, but you do find that oftentimes a lot of these mall operators are having some success, and I think a lot of that is due to the redevelopment that you're seeing in a lot of malls. I went to a mall in Houston earlier in 2018 that ended up being mostly vacant. I would say 90% vacant. But part of that 10%, Trent, was a fitness center, a very large fitness center that went into a space that could have been a Sears previously. So because of that, I think this has really helped the numbers at the top line for a lot of these mall operators, these real estate developers, and these REITs that we often talk about on the podcast as they disclose their quarterly earnings. Over the last several years, we have really seen the pendulum shift from analysts saying that retail is dead, or at least retail brick and mortar is dead, to saying there is, in fact, a place for brick and mortar stores, or at the very least, dynamic mixed-use development that I just touched on there, talking about gyms in certain malls around the country. So if you look at a quote from Barbara Denham, a senior economist at Reese, she said that given the many store closures across the U.S., the minimal changes in vacancy rates show that the retail sector has withstood the structural changes in the industry. She goes on to say that many feared that vacancy rates would soar and that rents would plummet, but this did not occur, and this doomsday prognostication proved to be overblown, and we could not agree more. And in fact, over the last couple of years on this very podcast, we talked about the fact that people still love to go into supermarkets to look at their own produce, to buy their own food that they're going to be taking home for the week ahead. And I think that's a very important point. However, if you extrapolate that, if you look at other sectors of the retail economy, if you think about cosmetics, Blue Mercury comes to mind, Sephora comes to mind, Ulta Beauty, that customer service experience is extremely beneficial for those coming in and trying on a new product, especially those that perhaps maybe have never worn makeup prior. So I think you really have to think about these scenarios and think about it in your local economy, how that affects the day-to-day progress that you're seeing in some of these retail centers, because a lot of this retail real estate is really service-oriented. So it's not just about the big box stores. It's not just about Sears and Kmart closing locations. It's really about the entire picture. Lauren Thomas from CNBC points out that the Sears closures in the coming months that were just announced could hurt vacancy rates, which is absolutely a concern. However, in a story that Trent covered last month, we do see that mall owners are actually looking forward to the day that Sears leaves. Reason being, Sears is often paying under market rate for leases. And oftentimes these stores, Trent, have just not been taken care of. You look at leaking roofs. In fact, I posted a picture of a Sears on our Instagram at Retail Podcast, and you see that Sears stores just have not had the capital improvements that they need to sustain the sort of image that a lot of mall owners want to have. If you think about Macy's or JCPenney, even to this day, they're pretty kept up versus Sears. So I think a lot of people are seeing this more as an opportunity rather than a detriment to their business. If you were a smaller niche retailer, would you rather be by a Macy's or one of the last Sears? And I think this is a big question that a lot of people have to answer. And I think oftentimes you're going to want to be, if you're a smaller retailer, where the traffic is. And I say that to say this: mall owners are going to want to redevelop those abandoned Sears locations sooner than later, because they don't want that entire side of the mall to be vacant. It's a very important point. You really have to think about the traffic. You have to think about your current retailers that are already existing that were by the Sears that is going to close too. What are they thinking? Are they already looking for other spots in the mall to move their business? So it's very important that you take care of not only your future tenants, but your current tenants as well. And I mentioned a recent trip to a Westminster mall here in the LA area where I now live. And there's now a gym, a trampoline park for kids, a Target, by the way, that was redeveloped, a food court with full service restaurants as opposed to just QSRs, and several low-end retailers at certain areas of the mall as well. You think of resale shops where they're selling used jeans, an office space also for a couple nonprofit groups. They have done pretty much everything they can to make sure that their vacancy rates remain fairly small and that occupancy stays strong no matter the different types of traffic that are coming into their malls. At least people are coming in. And by the way, I would say that the highest traffic for them was right around that Target. So it's extremely important for them, even if they're cutting lease rates down a little bit, to keep those stores occupied.
I actually have a mall near me where I live in Colorado, Layton, where they actually have a high school in the mall, or a charter school in the mall. There's a church in the mall. But again, all of those can be traffic drivers. And you think of something like a high school in a shopping mall, and you think at first that maybe doesn't match up. But then you think about your 14 to 18-year-old kids getting out of high school every single day and having a huge shopping center right at their fingertips. So certainly is a traffic driver there. Now, as far as retail real estate is concerned, in the bigger picture, there's a larger theme that some people have been warning of. And this is a theme that's come up on a couple of earnings calls, most notably the Tile Shop. When they came out with earnings back in November, they mentioned it. That's the tariff issue. And many of the retailers that we've covered recently are directly affected by a potential increase in tariffs. And while they are doing the best they can to mitigate cost differences, many are going to be unavoidable. Look, especially if you source a lot of your goods from China, if these tariffs continue to rise with these Chinese goods, that's going to hurt your bottom line. And if you're unable to pass these pricing pressures onto the consumer, we could, in theory, see a consolidation in certain areas that could eventually affect the retail real estate market. Now, beyond that, many smaller concepts with only a few stores in total could be hurt by minimum wage increases, something we'll talk about later on in the show, and increased state regulation. Now, while larger retailers like Walmart, Costco, and Amazon have been championing increases in base hourly rates, other retailers are struggling to keep margins strong, especially the smaller ones, especially the mom and pop ones. While the trickle-down effect may not translate into store closings for regional retailers and specialty shops necessarily, It may stifle growth plans, which could affect occupancy rates going forwards. If you have a space in a market that you want to transition to that's suddenly open and you are a smaller regional retailer, you know, you may not have the capital to go forward and expend on those. And, you know, not only is it wage increases, but also some of the tax bills that have been proposed, like, for example, the one in Seattle. We talked about it on the show, how, you know, Amazon would have potentially been hurt by that worker tax or that so-called worker tax, but it's a revenue-based system, so grocery stores are going to be hurt. Anyone that has a lot of sales but low margins, like, for example, convenience stores, could potentially be hurt by such a system. Now, according to CoStar, there is a potential for closing around 40% more retail square footage than was closed last year, so an increase in retail square footage closed, and this is according to CoStar. I'm not really sure this is going to pan out like CoStar thinks it will, because we did lose quite a bit of retail square footage last year. And of course, we have to factor in Kmart, Sears as large square footage stores that we know will likely be closing here in the coming year. But in that batch that CoStar cited are retailers like Victoria's Secret and Gap. They continue to struggle in some areas relative to their previous success, although we've talked about Gap turning around with some of their stores in their system. We've also talked about Victoria's Secret and how they might have a little bit of momentum now over the next couple of months to be able to continue to keep a lot of those locations open. So what they don't account for in this study, CoStar that is new incoming tenants. So Layton's talking about a fitness center, a trampoline complex. And while numbers like 145 million square feet of space to be closed sounds like a lot, there are always massive absolute fluctuations because of the large amount of space always outstanding in the heavily retailed United States. You know, the United States has a ton of retail square footage that's out there. We see these fluctuations on a regular basis. And just because something is opened up in 2019 doesn't mean that it will be filled or filled by retailers like, for example, e-commerce retailers, the likes of which, like Warby Parker and Tuft & Needle, for example, have begun to open up showrooms and take up some of that square footage once again. Fun fact about last year's 90 million square feet of lost space, in fact, Bon-Ton's over 200 store closures made up over a quarter of the lost space, with 24 million square feet left vacant, a lot of it also coming from the aforementioned Toys R Us, as I talked about. Now, currently, the U.S. still has nearly 24 square feet of retail space per person. Some say that's too much to the U.S. when compared to 16 in Canada and 11 in Australia. However, if we look at it this way, when do consumers really complain about too much square footage? A new Costco just opened up by Layton. It's absolutely packed at all times of the day, and they have a 160,000 square foot store. Should they downsize? Probably not. You don't want to compress those people into a smaller berth, so to speak. So just because you compare it to other countries, I think the retail dynamics in the U.S. are certainly different. And we're going to talk about a retailer later on in the show that said, hey, we're going to downsize some of our stores. They're actually deciding to go the other way. And we'll talk about that in the second half. So a lot of interesting points to make when we're talking about some 40% more square footage potentially being closed in 2019 over 2018. Again, a lot of times people are talking about smaller square footage movements, and we're seeing a lot of retailers head that way. But again, ultimately, it comes down to traffic. And if your traffic is still high and you can barely fit a certain number of shoppers within the store as it is, where are you really going to milk that square footage from? Not everyone is in that same circumstance as Kohl's and JCPenney, where they have square footage to burn.
Exactly. And I think that's a really good point that you make, Trent. And I think it really does help to put it in perspective when everybody says that the United States is over-retailed and that we have too much square footage per person. I think it really helps to put it in perspective to say that the United States as a whole is actually bigger than most other countries. I believe it ranks third or fourth in terms of actual real estate that can be utilized, or actual land that can be utilized for retail real estate. So again, it's a little bit hard to compare the United States with other countries and other countries that may not even be as developed here. So I think in terms of what we think will happen for the full 2019 calendar year, we would be inclined to agree with the summary statements from restating that vacancy rates will remain neutral for the full year. This would indicate that closures from last year and many of the new closures that are going to occur in the first half of this year are going to be backfilled either through redevelopment, like we've been mentioning throughout this story, or through conventional up-and-coming retailers like At Home that are growing their footprint throughout the United States. You look at At Home, they're taking over former Kmart's, former Target locations, in fact. very, very large spaces that would be tough to redevelop and that a lot of people weren't thinking were actually going to be backfilled in the near term, but they were and they are. So I think the main reason we think that vacancy rates will be steady is that landlords are slightly adjusting their ways in terms of their prevailing strategy used at the negotiating table. Historically, you see option periods always having a lease bump, and those lease bumps are not always small, maybe 5, 10, 15%. That's a lot of money. But now you look at mall leases, even though we did see a modest bump at the end of the fourth quarter of last year, about 0.2%, it really has gone up and down because a lot of landlords are deciding to renegotiate their leases to be a little bit more accommodating for their tenants, especially those long-term tenants that may be struggling, but that really have shown that they're consistent in terms of paying on time and that they're there for the long haul. So this indicates that short or midterm deals have been cut with tenants threatening to leave as lease rates, again, really up and down in terms of the U.S. landscape, in terms of conventional malls. Having a healthy long-term tenant is often more valuable, by the way, at a lower lease rate than having to fill a vacancy or backfilling a space with subpar tenant with little track record to go off of. And I think this really plays into the idea that landlords should be paying more attention to just keeping everything fully occupied, thinking about those traffic dynamics. Malls, whether indoor or outdoor, have seemingly been a lot better at acknowledging how current tenants appreciate fully leased properties and that traffic levels overall will be better if everything is occupied. Again, it really circles around redevelopment in a number of different areas, but it is really valuable. If you're a small business owner that you are starting an up-and-coming shop, a niche shop that only has 1 to 2 locations, you really don't want to be in a mall that is completely vacant. You'd rather be in a mall that has a gym next door or, like we were saying earlier, a trampoline park even. As long as some people are coming by to peruse your storefront, I think is a very important facet for the small business owner. We move on with our second story. The Wall Street Journal reports that Amazon is seeking to expand Whole Foods' brick and mortar footprint. And this doesn't strike us too much as being odd, as we talked or at least assumed this would be the case over the last year and a half, 2 years. There really hasn't been much talk of Amazon slowing its role in terms of expanding Whole Foods' footprint. However, the reason they're doing it is more of what you may think when it has everything to do with omnichannel and everything that they've been trying to do with two-hour delivery. So speaking of expanding what some have already called an over-retailed U.S., Amazon is looking for multiple areas to increase their metropolitan penetration. Before we get into the details, we must note that Whole Foods often opens up shop in new centers, therefore not really backfilling some of the larger store vacancies that may or may not be included in our previous story. They like to go in new up-and-coming areas that have a little bit better of a demographic. The expansion, by the way, is rumored to come as Amazon seeks to expand their reach for buy online, pickup in store, and local delivery options. The highlight of this story is probably going to be on the delivery front. The current plans, which have not been made official, look to add stores in areas that currently do not have robust two-hour delivery programs already in place. There's a number of areas throughout the United States that we'll get into that already do. Currently, their two-hour delivery system is aided by stores and distribution centers in larger metropolitan areas like New York City and LA, of course. Unnamed sources said that parts of Idaho and southern Utah and Wyoming are pretty much target markets because Whole Foods currently has no locations, and that's one of the reasons why. But not only do they not have Whole Foods locations already, and it's potentially going to be a competitive area for them in the grocery space, they don't have two-hour delivery. And again, I think that's going to be a focal point for the story. But for us, Utah is a natural extension. As you look, it's really a no-brainer for that immediate area all around Utah, except for northern parts of Utah where it is highly concentrated by a lot of regional grocers such as Harmon's Neighborhood Grocery and Lucky Stores, but also Trader Joe's is pretty much all around the state of Utah. But I say Utah because besides those northern areas, Trent, there's just really not a lot of competition for Whole Foods to come in. I think it's pretty much going to be a win-win. Aside from Utah, I don't know much about the dynamics of Wyoming other than they are in need of more distribution in terms of the e-commerce front.
Yeah, and as far as Utah is concerned, you know, we talk about them being really a growing market, or that state being a growing market as a whole, particularly the Salt Lake City metro area. Wyoming growing a bit more slowly, but Idaho, Boise is actually one of the fastest growing metro areas in the country. Not something that you think about a lot, but Whole Foods trying to make headway into Albertson's backyard. And part of the strategy to build out or rent more stores is that 2-hour delivery window, but also the company's planning to make sure that nearly all 500 current stores can go ahead and service the surrounding neighborhoods themselves. And this is still quite a struggle in densely populated areas where the company can get hamstrung easily by simple issues. Not only in-store congestion, which is something we've talked about with Kroger's fulfillment program, but also traffic in and around the stores. And we think to Amazon's current, or shall we say, first headquarters now in Seattle, where the city hired retired U.S. Air Force Major General Mike Worden to help Seattle through the major traffic battles caused by the closure of the viaduct there, Washington Highway 99, and several other large-scale projects. If you're not familiar with the Seattle metro area, the closure of the viaduct pretty much pushed a lot of traffic over to I-5, which is one of the main arterial roads that went through downtown. The viaduct went right along the Sound there on the other side of downtown. So closing that off made a lot of headaches for Amazon. They actually brought someone on board simply for that. And getting to work for some in that area, or any area at this point, may take well over 2 hours. A lot of people in Southern California, a lot of people on the East Coast, feeling the same pressures there. Now, relate that to getting a carton of eggs ordered, picked up in store, and then delivered to your doorstep in such a crowded metropolis is very difficult, regardless of how many Whole Foods there are or how many distribution hubs there are. You're really at the mercy of the traffic around you. Now, according to the Wall Street Journal, Prime Now services do include a 2-hour delivery option to subscribers in more than 60 cities, an online grocery pickup from Whole Foods in as little as 30 minutes from nearly 30 cities. Now, it's unclear to us how many orders have been actually on time, as there actually aren't any delivery guarantees usually here, despite the advertised window. Anecdotally, it seems that 2-hour and 30 minutes delivery extensions both run fairly well for Whole Foods. But anyway, to recap, Whole Foods, 496 stores in North America and the UK. Of those, they have over 20 Whole Foods 365, which is the lower cost version of the Whole Foods. It's kind of takes that store brand, or that in-house brand of 365, expands it out to the entire store. Since Amazon purchased the grocery chain, plans for broader Whole Foods 365 penetration have stayed in place. We've actually seen the number of Whole Foods 365 locations grow since Amazon took over. In fact, prices slightly more competitive from what we've seen lately versus competition from the likes of Aldi Organics and Trader Joe's. And while some still point out that Aldi and Trader Joe's do beat on pricing in a number of areas, Whole Foods does have the inherent perks offered from Prime members. Plus, just in terms of marketing, just in terms of position in the marketplace and mental position in the marketplace, Whole Foods is still slightly elevated above their competition, including Kroger's organic selection and, of course, Sprouts. But even with those deals for Prime members built in, still generally Whole Foods is a ways off from competing price-wise with Trader Joe's, Aldi, Kroger, and Sprouts. So we'll see exactly where this expansion takes them. You know, in terms of some of the stores that Leighton was mentioning, Sprouts does have penetration into the Salt Lake City market. The Boise market is already served by a number of organic selections. Albertsons is opening up larger stores with larger organic selections in Boise. So it could be tough to make inroads into certain markets, but Whole Foods and Amazon willing to do that so that they can get to more people through their delivery platform. You know, it's been a while since we brought this up on the podcast, but 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes a day. I read more than 30 minutes a day, not that I'm necessarily financially successful, but I know Leighton does as well. You know, people that are financially successful, they're hungry for knowledge. They continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get. And Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine. Now, if you're like me, the list of books you want to read, or the list of books people suggest I read, is never ending and always expanding. I've, in fact, got several on my nightstand that I'm waiting to read, and I don't have time to read them all, and likely neither do you. But our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all.
Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful moments so you can read or listen to them in just under 15 minutes, all from your phone. With Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen pretty much anywhere. I personally like to listen to Blinkist while I'm on my way to work because now I do have a more extensive drive out in California. But I'll tell you what, Trent, the Blinkist library is massive, from timeless classics like Freakonomics to Amazon's current bestseller like Getting Things Done. They have a ton of titles to choose from.
Ton of titles, another one, the 4-Hour Work Week, also the 80-20 Principle, and right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. That's Blinkist.com/retail. We kick off the second half of this week's news portion with a regional retailer that may be expanding outside of their regional bounds as Fleet Farm, also known as Mills Fleet Farm, continues their march westward in announcing a new store this last week in Rapid City, South Dakota, and expansion for another location in Minnesota. And you might ask, why are we including what appears to be a local story on a national retail podcast? After all, locations open and close and expand all the time. Why is it of note for Fleet Farm here? Well, for a couple of reasons. One, Fleet Farm has quietly been expanding their reach west from their wheelhouse in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Their main distributorship is actually in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And second, we're constantly intrigued by Fleet Farm's doubling down on their strategy. By this, we mean they are consistently investing in larger and larger store footprints, bringing more and more merchandise into the store, getting away from specialization, while the rest of the retail industry actually goes the other way. They're looking at smaller and smaller footprints and potentially more specialization in certain circumstances. Now, for evidence of their obsession with large footprint stores, look no further than this proposed new store in Rapid City. Now, local news outlets in Rapid City report that the new complex for Fleet Farm will be 202,000 square feet. Layton talked about Costco being big at 160,000 square feet. This is 25% bigger than that, and compared to other retailers in the farm and home space, this is massive. So for those that don't know, Fleet Farm usually offers a large array of not only clothing, but farm and home supplies, power equipment, that type of thing, also outdoors gear. So looking at other retailers in this space, Tractor Supply stores usually between 18 to 30,000 square feet with some exceptions. Orscheln stores in the Midwest, based out of Missouri, typically in the same ballpark. Big R stores, they have several different iterations throughout the country in the Pacific Northwest, in the traditional Midwest around Ohio and Illinois, also in Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming. Those are slightly larger, but they're rarely larger than 40,000 square feet. Atwood stores, usually in Oklahoma, Texas, the South, tend to be larger than 34,000 square feet, but no more than 50,000 in general. So here we're talking about a farm and home retailer that is larger than even most Lowe's or Home Depot's, which is stunning indeed, considering a lot of the talk, particularly surrounding Lowe's, has been about seeing how you can compress that overall footprint. And we should mention that one of the reasons for the large square footage stores for Fleet Farm is not just simply because they have a lot of merchandise, although they do, but it's for ease of movement for merchandise. They sell a lot of riding mowers, larger power equipment, large ride-on tillers, that type of thing. And all of these are usually housed indoors, in part for customer comfort. Think about where their stores are. We're talking about the Dakotas, Minnesota, Wisconsin. These are areas that get cold for a lot of the year, and in fact, it's cold or snowing there for a good part of the year. So having this enormous square footprint allows customers to browse without needing to bundle up in comparison to Tractor Supply Company or other competitors who often display these things outside. But it's also necessary to have enormously wide aisles so that you can pull that merchandise out onto the floor so that you're not crowding customers in a similar fashion as, say, Home Depot or Lowe's has wide aisles so you can get forklifts and the like through. So, Layton, I want to talk real quick about this new Fleet Farm location specifically and its location. It'll be near Rushmore Crossing in Rapid City. And I actually visited the shop complex when it was first beginning to develop significantly and can confirm this is a growing area of the town, which means the land was either likely not cheap or this is something that Fleet Farm has been sitting on planning for some time.
Yeah, one thing to note, this store will be about 350 miles further west than the current westernmost store. This may either prove to be a burden for their new Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin distribution center, or they are potentially planning to somehow widen their distribution capabilities and open more locations this far west in the future. So I would probably assume the latter, but we will wait and see for that particular detail. For those unfamiliar with the Fleet Farm concept, the retail complexes usually include a car wash, fuel station, a large garden area, and other home goods. However, they are more of a one-stop shop than many of the other retailers that we just mentioned. And you can assume that by me saying that they have a car wash and fuel station on their property. But as they offer hunting and fishing gear is pretty common, as well as other things like pet grooming as well. So they are directly competing with some of those retailers that Trent mentioned. And some of those other chains, by the way, offer a lot of hunting and fishing gear, but Murdoch's probably comes to mind the most in that particular space. Murdoch's, by the way, is a chain whose territory Fleet Farm is slowly inching towards. Their footprint reaches as far east as western Nebraska. So definitely entering in to Murdoch's territory. Now, the Rapid City Fleet Farm isn't expected to be completed until the end of this year, but it comes in an era where other notable capital investment from the company is occurring. This era began when New York investment firm KKR bought the company in the beginning of 2017. Since that point, we've seen store remodels, store expansions, as well as new locations introduced. So they really believe in the concept. At the time of the acquisition, in fact, the chain had 37 stores. Now they have around 42, with several more in the works this year. So a lot of groundbreaking. And in terms of a percent increase, that is pretty substantial for such a small chain. It would be no surprise to see the number reach 50, or at least around 50 by 2020. What is interesting is that right after the acquisition, Trent, back in 2017, CEO Derek Prell told the Minnesota Star Tribune that they were seeking to downsize their square footage, noting a new Monticello, Minnesota store at 120,000 square feet. Since that point, however, they've actually sought to expand certain stores, including one announced this week, the one in Waite Park, Minnesota. That store will add some 22,000 square feet to its existing nearly 190,000 square feet, certainly suggesting that they've found larger stores to be working well for them, uniquely well for them. They are adding to their outdoor section, but their biggest addition came as a surprise to us as Prell announced that the refreshed Waite Park store will begin to offer a wider array of groceries, including a robust refrigerated section and a freezer section as well. And this is actually the first remodel of this particular kind in the Fleet Farm system, according to the St. Cloud Times, although other remodels have indeed been done recently. Prell told the newspaper that the addition of more groceries was in response to, guess what, consumer demand, stating that consumers ended up wanting the convenience of a one-stop shop. So just when you thought they were a one-stop shop before, it looks as though they're adding groceries into the foray.
And he actually put this in the perspective of auto parts and tools. He said when customers are coming in, getting something else, getting something for their farm or home, they want to be able to also pick up a jug of milk or a carton of eggs or even some of their frozen food offerings. And prior to this point, Fleet Farm stores have had just very basic food offerings, more dry goods, candy, and so forth, not unlike what you would see at an Atwoods or a Tractor Supply or an Orscheln's. But they expect the remodel for this location to actually be completed in April. And when it is turned around, and by the way, that's an extremely quick turnaround for such a large initiative, you're going to see a large refrigerated goods section, a fairly decent freezer section for what this retailer is about. And it's interesting because the food expansion is such a quick pivot for Prell and company. And I think it really speaks to kind of what Leighton was talking about earlier on in the podcast, which is that, you know, if you've got the traffic, if you've got the people there and the people want other goods in the store, why not expand? It's kind of the same thing that took Meijer stores in the Michigan area and the upper Midwest to expand and grow into the larger square footage locations that are so popular up there today, is that customers kept demanding more and more merchandise, and the larger square footprint hasn't really hindered them. Although Meijer's played with some smaller square footprint stores over the course of the years, the larger square footprint really hasn't hindered them either in terms of being able to expand or in terms of getting into new markets. And one thing that Prell has mentioned in the past, not necessarily with these interviews that he's done, but interviews back in 2017, back in early 2018, he mentioned that Fleet Farm, you're really looking at the second ring of a city. So if you have a city, you're not looking at the first ring or the first set of suburbs, really the second most suburbs out. A couple of different reasons. One is land is, of course, more plentiful there. But then the second is you get the confluence of those coming in from the city that might be urban gardeners, that type of thing, and those coming from the outer lying areas. These stores are just simply far too big to put in a market of, say, 15,000 people. But if you put them in an outer suburb where the market of 15,000 people can easily make it to the Fleet Farm, suddenly that 30-minute drive, especially if you can pick up groceries at the same time, becomes a little bit more intriguing to that customer. And that's why I mentioned this pivot from working towards smaller stores when the company was first bought a couple of years ago to now expanding even their largest locations is an interesting one. We'll see how it plays out in the long term. Now, as you might be able to guess, we think if customers are demanding this, then sure, it has the capacity to work out. And it's all well and good if they can remain operational in these locations. But should they ever have to close one or more, that's a huge footprint from a real estate perspective to attempt to fill and to have to divide up. And as a short final story here on the podcast, as the new year is upon us, several states have minimum wage hikes going into effect or that have already gone into effect as of January 1st. Now, minimum wage hikes, anytime we talk about them, we talk about the fact that they may exacerbate the already increasing costs of staffing stores for many larger retailers, especially those with a footprint in larger cities. Some of these minimum wage hikes are actually hikes designed for larger retailers or larger companies in general to pay higher wages to those workers. Now, granted, there's the other side of that, which states that, hey, if workers are getting paid more, they also may spend more in the overall retail landscape. So via previously passed measures, obviously had to be passed before January 1st, to raise minimum hourly wages in certain states and municipalities, roughly 17 million working class people may be affected and may see a bit of a larger paycheck here.
Minimum wage hikes have been pretty much a hot button issue for many. The federal government has taken a hands-off approach, both in publicly available rhetoric and in action, or pretty much inaction. So the federal minimum wage is still $7.25. They've said they pretty much they're going to leave it up to the states to make a decision as to whether to raise their minimum wage. So a lot of states are taking it upon themselves to pass certain measures to do so. And this is something that has sort of been a theme for the last couple of years that we've been keeping up with on the podcast. And we'll talk about individual municipalities that pass certain things as they occur. But this has been an area where 16 different states in January of 2018 still have the federal minimum wage of $7.25, Trent. So a lot of different states still haven't raised from the federal minimum wage. And it looks as though there are going to be a handful of states that continue onward with that same path this year. However, this story is going to surround the states that are looking to pass wage hikes in 2019, or at least a little bit of a bump, part of a larger package. The common misconception here is that the federal minimum wage has not kept up with the inflation. However, if you broaden the time horizon from when the federal minimum wage was first implemented, when it first became an actual thing from the government, the federal minimum wage started in 1938 at a rate of 25 cents per hour. Luckily, we all don't make that now, but if you adjust for inflation and look at a different metric or a different set of metrics, you can see that that would equate to around $5 an hour in today's dollar. So you compare $5 an hour versus the 1938 date, and you fast forward to today in 2019, it's around $2 less than the federal minimum wage. So still not too terrible. However, if you make another assumption here or another analysis, you can see that the minimum wage, if in 1968 had kept up with labor productivity's growth, it would have reached 1933 in 2017. This is saying that basically human capital is much more productive, they're much more efficient than they were in 1938 or any time before this year, pretty much. So therefore, the workers should essentially, the argument it could be made, be making a lot more money because their productivity per hour is much, much more than it was when they first began the federal minimum wage. But politics aside, opinions aside, we must look and see how it affects retail in 2019. And this is our main story, the 2019 wage increases here. We do acknowledge that some communities are obviously much more expensive to live in than others. This is a huge reason for communities in Seattle, which we alluded to now. It's extremely populated and competitive with horrible traffic, but they're looking to raise their minimum wages to around $15 an hour in due time. New York's employees have already seen a bump to $15 an hour. Some employees in Manhattan were saying that they went from $7.50 to $15 an hour. So some New York City workers, therefore, will be seeing close to double in some circumstances before taxes, of course. They will be in probably a different tax bracket depending on your personal situation. But according to USA Today, workers in up to 21 other states and, of course, the District of Columbia will receive higher minimum wages this year. This is according to, by the way, the National Employment Law Project report. And North Dakota, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Utah, and Idaho, among a few other states, will still only have the federal statute dictating the minimum wage. So those states that I just mentioned, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, North Dakota, they will not be affected by anything that is going on in any other state. Therefore, their minimum wage by default will still be $7.25. Areas in Colorado, California, Washington, Florida, Alaska, among others, are going to see increases. And this is, again, what the story is about. Most increases are going to be structured in such a way that employers are given several quarters or half years or full years to follow past guidelines. So there's going to be sort of a staggering of increased wages. It's going to be a stair-step approach. Alaska, as an example, actually is not taking a stair-step approach. They are going to do a one-time adjustment. Current minimum wage in Alaska, by the way, is $9.84 per hour. The 2019 minimum wage hikes it 5 cents. So some of these are going to be a little more dramatic than others. California has divided criteria depending on, actually, on how big your employer is. So if you're a worker in California, it depends how large your company, the company you work for, is, and that is going to affect your minimum wage there. In 2019, if you work for a larger company in California, the minimum wage will go to $12 an hour, and for smaller companies, it will go to $11 an hour. So if you work for a smaller company, you are going to be hamstrung a little bit, but that is to, in fact, help small business growth. Their goal is to hit $15 an hour for everybody between 2022 and 2023. So moving onward, nearly half of the increases are attributed to increments in a set structured plan. So I already alluded to that and how California is hoping to set forth their structure to reach the $15 an hour benchmark. But the other half that are increasing their wages, Trent, the other half of the states here on our list of 22, these are one-time agreements that they've really chosen to pass as part of a cost of living adjustment. And what is funny here is not all of the states have the same percent increase based on cost of living. So it's not a federal mandate or any sort of federal inflation number that they're going on. They're not going by the CPI or anything like that. They're simply going by set criteria set forth by lawmakers in that individual state. But what is also interesting is that this theory doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because if you look and compare these increases, these cost of living adjustments in the states that are doing it, for instance, the 5 cents in Alaska, it still doesn't match up with the inflation per annual basis for these individual states. So would be very curious to see the different calculations each state is using. Regardless of the percent increase year over year for the minimum wage hikes, it's still a positive thing, I think, for the worker entering the workforce.
And, you know, Leighton, you mentioned Colorado being one of those states increasing their minimum wage. Of course, I live in Colorado. I mentioned that earlier, but very few retailers, and for that matter, very few QSRs even paid the earlier $10 minimum wage. A lot of QSRs, you know, your Burger Kings, McDonald's, Carl's Jr.'s of the world, they were already paying higher than that $10 minimum wage. Obviously, Costco, Target, among those paying higher than that minimum wage already. So I'm not sure how many retail employees are actually going to see a benefit from this, but again, they raised it to $11.10 as of January 1st, 2019. Kind of interesting because you mentioned a few states, including Kansas and Oklahoma, neighboring states to Colorado, that still have $7.25 minimum wage. All in all, this may sound pretty good for the entry-level worker getting a job in the service industry, particularly on that retail floor. Many of the states we've discussed already have those wages at or near the $10 mark, but for retailers, it becomes a bit harder to increase margins, which of course is, if you're publicly owned, what shareholders are going to want, even with a substantial price cut. As evidenced by the last 2 years in retail, it's obvious that the common customer still wants a high degree of customer service, whether that's in brick and mortar or in a setting like Amazon, where fulfillment and delivery is becoming a crucial part of the retail landscape. Many of those delivery drivers looking to get paid more than that $10 base that seems to be the new norm. And some delivery drivers are, of course, going to be contract workers who oftentimes are going to be paid on a per delivery basis. And so the minimum wage increase may not affect them other than providing competition for their services potentially in the long term. Now, the increased cost of doing business for retailers therefore cannot be entirely mitigated by automation and longer term efficiencies, because people are looking for that customer service, because you have to have some personalization somewhere along the line. If anything, this was evidenced by Whole Foods soon after the Amazon acquisition, where Amazon learned the hard way that customers like Whole Foods not only for their product selection and transparency, but also that high degree of customer service they're used to getting there. Now, Walmart, for their part, has always had a hard time learning that better customer service or a more qualified worker is a winning strategy, even though they still struggle to achieve the level of service of Target or Costco. When you see retail surveys regarding service, they have developed a winning strategy, or a more winning strategy, of supplying more workers to grocery pickup and buy online pickup in store options. This was something they were hamstrung in 3 to 4 years ago. But this comes at a cost to the bottom line, especially as workers will be getting paid more now in 22 states. Now, in summary, clear to us that maybe not everyone in that touted 17 million number will be positively affected, but some retail employees certainly will. From the business side, more interesting for us to see if there's any contraction in hiring for new or growing or mature businesses, given these new constraints, whether they try to trim back on payroll through attrition or whether they, like Target has, keep their hiring up. Lastly, the cost of goods at the consumer level likely to rise, something we've already seen in the full-service restaurant industry quite clearly over the last 2 years. Operators like Darden and Texas Roadhouse, for example, have passed staff's wages onto the menu, even though wages oftentimes in that FSR category tend to be fairly low because you have tips making up the difference. Customers, luckily, at least so far, have been willing to pay the difference, but general merchandise retail and the ultra-competitive grocery space, where we're always seemingly talking about margin compression, is an entirely different animal, in that dining out, more discretionary, and people, let's face it, they can be more price conscious when it comes to general merchandise and grocery retail, because they have options, and options that are increasing as time goes forward.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look at one story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or shoot, maybe all of 2019. And we'll start with Leighton.
So my story has to do with the last story, and we're going to be talking about food inflation, something that we're going to be talking about for the next few months, in my opinion. The USDA Economic Research Service ended up coming out with a forecast that said at-home consumer food is set to rise between 1% and 2% in 2019, and that's a little bit higher than the 0 to 1% that we've been seeing, sometimes negative in some sectors of the grocery industry for 2018, and this rise is actually expected for 2019 would mark the fourth straight year of deflating or lower than average food inflating prices. What that means is basically that even though grocery prices are going up, it's still lower than the 2% or 1.9% inflation that we've been seeing. What's interesting about this report, Trent, I'm not going to go too much into it because it is my looking ahead story, but it does include some of the numbers that we've been seeing for the last few quarters. So it pretty much backs up what the large retailers like Target and Walmart have been saying in terms of the areas of the grocery department that have been seeing a rise in pricing. So dairy products, fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, all coming up 2 to 3% in the next year or so. I think that's a very big warning sign for a lot of people. But if you're like me, you probably don't consume as much dairy anyway. So I think the big areas that it's going to affect for a vast amount of consumers, a wide variety of consumers, I should say, in the grocery space are fresh vegetables and fresh fruit. So you're seeing a rise between 2 and 3.5% in those areas. I think that's going to be fairly significant. What's interesting, what struck me as odd, is that despite all of the regulation and all of the proposed legislation regarding sugars and sweets, that category is still not expected to rise. It's actually going to be around 0% for the upcoming year, which means, by the way, it's going to be significantly less than inflation. So prices theoretically are going to drop off versus last year.
So my story is about the home improvement chain Lowe's. It actually has to do with our last story here. But the reason I'm looking ahead is Lowe's has announced that they're actually going to begin hiring, not just for seasonal positions. As we know, home improvement stores like Home Depot and Lowe's adds seasonal positions to basically bolster their garden centers in the regular spring rush that they have. They're going to add about 50,000 of those, but they also look to add about 10,000 permanent associates across its merchandising service team. Basically, this is the team in charge of inventory control, resets in the store, that type of thing. So very interesting announcement here. We've spent the better part of the last 3 months kind of bagging on Lowe's and unsure as to their strategy. And honestly, this makes us even more unsure as to what Lowe's strategy is, because Lowe's has been regularly cutting positions over the last couple of years. They cut 2,400 jobs at the beginning of 2017. They cut more jobs here in 2018, most recently. But now they're looking to add to their merchandising service team. So we've seen some contraction, we've seen some expansion, and you're wondering if these are employees that will simply just be assigned to different positions than those employees that were laid off. But in that case, kind of looking back at things, it is so pricey to onboard new employees from, of course, everything that's talked about through the interview process, the background checking, all of that stuff, to actually training them on the floor. One has to wonder if it wouldn't have been better to just reassign some employees that were already laid off over the last couple of years in this circumstance. But nonetheless, Lowe's is adding help. So is this a sign of a potential turnaround? Is this a sign of Marvin Ellison perhaps shifting the in-store focus based on where employees are at in-store? Like I said, only time will tell. But one thing Leighton mentioned on a recent episode, you know, Lowe's employees have basically told us that they're not seeing some of these initiatives from the top down actually make their way to the sales floor. They haven't seen a lot of these changes that Ellison talks about and the rest of the leadership team talks about trickle down as yet, and it's been a little bit. So for all the media that these changes get, we haven't really seen that much impact. So I'm wondering if this will create that large of an impact on the store level and if this will ultimately help them make more efficient stores of their remaining store fleet, or if these are positions that will eventually have to be contracted again when Lowe's decides to do so in the future. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Big thanks to Blinkist and all of you for listening. So long until next week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.